Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Roundtable Plus webinar on India M&A lesson from 2014 for deal making in 2015. This event is being organized by Nishit Desa Associates in association with our supporting partners, IVCA, the Indian Private Equity and Venture Capital Association, and AIBI, Association of Investment Bankers of India. The speakers for today are Umakant Varotil, Assistant Professor, National University of Singapore, Vaibhav Parikh, Partner, M&A and Private Equity, Nishit Desa Associates, Nishil Joshipura, Partner, M&A and Private Equity, Nishit Desa Associates, Simone Rees, Co-Head, M&A and Private Equity, Nishit Desa Associates, and Ankit Mishra, Member, M&A and Private Equity, Nishit Desa Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. Should you need assistance during this conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Androids, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Also, please note this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the session to Ms. Simone Rees. Thank you, and over to you, ma'am.
Welcome all. We especially welcome our participants who have dialed in from Singapore, Japan, Hong Kong, and California to this conference. I would like to begin by borrowing the words from a famous jurist, American jurist, Justice Holmes, when he said, the life of law has not been logic, it has been experience. That is true in deal making, especially in India. The past has many lessons which we would like, which we would do well to learn from for the future. Borrowing from this spirit, we have kept our first of our many webinars this year, India M&A, on lessons from 2014 for deal making in 2015. We hope you will find this panel interesting and learn from it. We have a host of luminous speakers today. We hope that you will have you will learn from the experience of our speakers, as well as from the guests that have actually dialed in. To briefly lay down the flow of the discussions today, in the first segment, we will reflect on the experiences of 2014. And then in the next segment, we will analyze what is in store for 2015. But before I move to our speakers, let me take this opportunity to state that India is on the cusp of something fantastic. After almost three decades, India has a majority government. But what's more heartening is that the political discourse has moved from social-political issues to more economic issues. This is reflected in the levels of deal activity one has witnessed in 2014. In all, Indian companies have concluded 247 M&As and deals worth $16.17 billion in 2014. That's the highest since 2010, when 373 domestic deals worth $18.3 billion were reached. Indian companies across sectors are seeking expansion, betting that the economy will accelerate after 2 years of sub 5% growth. Likewise, globally, the India story is making headways. And this is perhaps just the tip of the iceberg. If one were to go by the reports of 2015, 2015 could be a landmark year. With M&A-friendly legislation, softening of some key regulators, which we will discuss later, robust domestic economic environment, there is room to believe that India could be the next global deal-making destination. This is also reflected by the confidence of the CEOs, the key architects in deal-making at the recent Davos meet, where Indian CEOs seem to be the most optimistic. Apparently, organizers had to make last-minute rearrangements to accommodate the massive attendance for Finance Minister Arun Jaitley's session this year, which is a stark contrast to last year's downsizing. With this, let us begin with the first segment. A question to you, Vaibhav. How do you look back at the M&A market in 2014? What has been your experience in terms of sectors that have seen deal activity and broadly the nature of deal activity?
Thank you, Simone. Welcome, everybody. It is a pleasure to have you on phone and in person in Mumbai. I'm speaking from Bangalore. I am audible, and if not, please pinpoint it. So again, any investment manager or analyst can give you a better numbers on what happened in M&A sector in 2014. But today I'm going to give you a lawyer's perspective on what we as a law firm or we as a legal fraternity saw and our observation on M&A in 2014. First, we do see activities earlier in time. And one of the observations which we had was we saw sharp uptake in activity from February 2014, which means that while the deals announcement have been a little later in the year, but the confidence in the economy actually came much before the new government was put in. Maybe because it was a hope that the new government will come in and which will be a stable government. Maybe that optimism already started a little early on. Or maybe it was a hope that in the way it is changing will bring a lot of economic benefits. But February itself, we saw a sharp uptake on M&A activity. We saw more deals happening in a sense that the deal failures were less compared to what we saw in 2013, maybe because of lesser fluctuation in foreign exchange, or maybe because the valuation had not yet shot to the roof. So today we saw a lot more deals happening compared to 2013. Even the time taken to complete the deal was reduced. So negotiations were happening faster, and we saw both parties being more accommodative. Only where things were delayed was mainly because it was outside the party's hands. So that is something which we observed in 2014. The sectors which we saw more deals happening, again, it's something which has been mentioned over even previous years. The largest sector we saw activities happening in number of deals has been on technology side. In technology side, specifically we saw on e-commerce. E-commerce has been flavor of the year in 2014. In e-commerce also, obviously e-commerce retailing has been a very active sector. There is a lot of competition in trying to be number one. So this is something which we saw a major activity in e-commerce retailing. But also in e-commerce services and e-commerce technology, where a lot of startups did get acquired, a lot of services company saw massive increase in activity compared to, let's say, 2013. Other than e-commerce, we saw activity in traditional technology sector like software services and BPO. Even there, the consolidation, the preparedness for India trying to take lead on technology services side was evident. Other than technology, a lot of activity in pharma, life science and healthcare area, financial services area, and to some extent even on infrastructure area. The other observation which we had was there were quite a bit of domestic deals compared to what was there in 2013. And also, the primary purpose which we saw where the deals were where the acquisition happened were to get new markets more than what we saw earlier was getting people or getting certain assets. Here the objective of the deals were new markets and new customers, which again shows optimism in the future in terms of how India is going to be positioned in the world economy. And also we saw slight uptake in acquisitions because of technology and some of the platform, which is something which at least in my experience was not very evident or was missing in earlier years. This is my take on what we saw in 2014. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vaibhav. And we will contrast 2014 and 2015 maybe in the next segment. But thank you for this. It looks like we've all been very busy in 2014. So Ankit, I think the next logical question will come to you. We've been discussing diligences, and I think sometimes that's the most important aspect of a deal because that's an eye opener for anyone. We've seen, SEBI, the recent spate of SEBI orders, whether it was in the DLF IPO case, the CARE IPO case. We've seen the Supreme Court's ruling in Nirma, where the Supreme Court actually made an observation saying that, acquirers should conduct due diligences. The Daiichi Ranbaxy fiasco also circled around diligence issues. Maybe you can give us your view in terms of what has been the level of and nature of diligence and how important it has been in 2014.
Thank you, Suman. I think you're bang on when you say that, the risks of not doing a good diligence have increased manifold. I think before we touch upon what's really happened in 2014, I think it's important to understand what's happened from 2008 onwards globally. So prior to the financial crisis, there was more boardroom confidence. People were making deals at a phenomenal pace. But post-2008, you see that boards are more conscious now, and part of it is because there's been a phenomenal increase in shareholder activism all over the world, and therefore the duties and liabilities on the board has increased. The boards are more conscious that they, if they want to create value, they need to do adequate due diligence, and if they are accountable to their shareholders, they need to do adequate due diligence. Now, in the Indian context, in the last few years also, we have seen a couple of cases which has come to light. One of the cases being the famous Daiichi and Ranbaxy case, where the acquirer was unable, due to lack of or inadequate diligence, to estimate the legal risks arising out of US FDA investigations. Similarly, last year we have also seen the Apollo Cooper deal, where a large body of shareholders of Apollo felt that the deal was entered into haste without doing adequate due diligence and without understanding the global problems that Cooper sort of had. We are repeatedly sort of hearing CEOs tell us that, it's okay, we can, CEOs as well as fund managers, GPs, they're telling us, it's we are able to explain it to our shareholders and LPs if a deal goes bad because of business and economic reasons, but if a deal goes bad because we are not able to identify red flags or address those red flags, then that's something that we are unable to sort of explain and causes huge liability on us. And as a result of which, we have seen an increase in sort of a more robust due diligence. We have seen a number of disputes immediately after the consummation of deals between private equity investors and promoters. And this is not because suddenly the business or economic climate has changed. It is simply because the investors did not fully appreciate and understand the level of risks they were taking, the sort of ethical issues that are involved in the business. Now, what was the issue in all these years? A part of it has to be blamed at least for listed companies, a part of it has to be blamed on the sort of regime we have. There was inadequate disclosures, though they were complying with the letter of the law. The disclosures made by listed companies leaves a lot to be desired, and as a result of which it was, and this coupled with the fact that the insider trading regulations prohibited or there was some sort of ambiguity on whether you could get access to unpublished price sensitive information while doing the diligence, caused a lot of issues, and as a result of which parties were not able to undertake a robust diligence. Second issue that we have found is that whenever there is a cross-border deal, acquirers are more concerned on conducting diligence where the key operations of the companies are. For example, if it's an Indian company with, say, 30% operations in Europe, the acquirers are conducting diligence in India, but when it comes to Europe, the level of diligence is not the same, and that is something that is causing a great deal of concern, because if there is an issue in Europe, it may not effectively, affect a large part of your operations, but, it could affect your immediate sort of price in India. So those things are not being factored in. The other thing that we are seeing is, we saw was that business diligence and legal diligence, there's not been adequate level of communication in the past years. The lawyers and the financial advisors are not communicating on their findings insofar as diligence is concerned. Now, what has really changed in 2014? I think what changed was because of these issues, because of shareholder activism, we are seeing a more robust level of diligence. And what do I mean by that? Essentially, what's happening is now, apart from the legal and financial diligence, where both parties, both the financial advisors, the business advisors, and the lawyers are communicating more, I think there are three aspects that has significantly changed. One is we are seeing more of forensic due diligence. Now, there are three parts to it, essentially. One is we are seeing the acquirers undertake more diligence or forensic study on the background of the controlling shareholders and the promoters. That's first aspect. Second aspect is that the acquirers are undertaking a more organizational sort of diligence, which means that they're looking at, the culture of the firm and addressing post-integration issues at the very outset itself, and also trying to understand what is the level of corporate governance that the entity has, and whether, they will be able to integrate their businesses with that entity, because there are huge risks attached in other developed jurisdictions. So they want to ensure that the level of corporate governance is in sync with their current organization. And the third aspect that we have seen, and recently we saw that in the when USL sort of spent a lot of time, understanding the anti-bribery risks or the mitigation or the systems that are placed in USL, because Diageo being a company headquartered in the UK, they had huge risks, and this is something that is increasingly becoming a norm. We're seeing more of anti-bribery diligence being done. I think those are the key points. One last point that we have observed, which is increasing in India, is the issue of how to mitigate gun jumping issues during the diligence process. Now, this is a well-established principle globally, but in India, it's still sort of an evolving story because we have a fairly new merger control regime. The issue is when two competitors, for example, Sun and Ranbaxy, are entering into a transaction at the time of the due diligence, what is the level of information that one can exchange with the other because there are potential antitrust risks? This is something that, deal makers will have to be aware of, and I will have to factor it before they move ahead in exchanging information, so signing the non-disclosure confidentiality agreement very early on in the deal-making process. I think those are the trends we see in 2015. Also, these sort of trends continue.
Thanks, Ankit. You had you touched upon key concepts like shareholder activism, boardroom confidence, the regulations or the lack of regulations or the inability of regulations to permit diligence, lack of disclosures, and things like that. I think they're all extremely important touchstones, and we will discuss things like shareholder activism later on in the session and also in the 2015 session. In terms of boardroom confidence, I think the liability of directors in doing diligences is something that we will also see how the regulations are looking at it in terms of, the regulations that will affect M&A in 2015. We're sitting at a time where we have new insider trading regulations that are already out, and we will discuss some of these aspects in the 2015 side of the panel. But I think, you touched upon key concepts which we've borrowed also from the US, we borrowed from the UK. And I think the next logical question should go to Professor Umakant, who maybe, Professor Umakant, if you can, as someone who is closely linked to M&A overseas and monitors M&A overseas, if you can give us your perspective from an international perspective, because India, we're always borrowing from the West. We're always trying to make our laws, we borrow concepts from the West. If you can give us your experience in terms of diligences for deals in India.
So in terms of comparative discussion about how due diligences might take place in other developed markets as opposed to what are the specific issues in India, I would like to build up a little bit on what Ankit already started off with, which is that there are some specific issues in India which may be different from what one is associated with in the international context. And just to run through with some of them, and there are M&A issues with diligence even in a lot of other international transactions, but that's just the way it is. But from an Indian context, I think one of the things which Ankit has mentioned is extremely important, which is companies tend to be driven by controlling shareholders and promoters as specified in India. So diligence cannot be limited only to the target entity. They might have to be a fair amount of diligence done on the promoters themselves, because integrity checks on the promoters would clearly give an indication as to how the company is run and what level of compliance and governance the company has been put to. So diligence on the promoter would be an important aspect, and that's something that we have learned over the years, including in the last couple of years, in the Indian context as well. And it is also the case that governance and disclosure norms may not be as sophisticated in India as they have been in the developed markets, although over the years, disclosure norms in India have developed to a large extent, but still there could be some incremental development that is required as far as disclosures are concerned. So in that context, I think a few of the more specific questions to think about while diligencing an Indian company. Given the way Indian companies are structured, one of the things that we've learned in the recent past is there needs to be a fair amount of diligence on related party transactions, because there could be a number of transactions that take place between group companies that might reduce the value of the target company itself. And there have been cases where lack of diligence on that part might end up being quite disruptive as far as the transaction is concerned. The other issues which are quite important from a diligence perspective that we learned a lot from relates to industries which require governmental licenses and approvals. And we've seen a lot of M&A deals happen in that space in recent years, for example, in the telecom industry, increasingly now in the banking sector, and the pharma sector, which has already been mentioned. And that's an area where issues relating to lack of diligencing on the license and the licensing process itself may relate to questions. And there, I suppose one of the ways to think about is, and that's a lesson we've learned, is merely looking at the paperwork and the legal documentation may not reveal the entire scenario. It might be necessary to delve a lot more deeper into the process itself, who within the company is managing that process, and what steps they are undertaking to do so, because a lack of thorough due diligence on that part could create issues going in the transaction, as we have seen. And linked to the government process is this whole question of the anti-corruption and bribery legislation, which is again becoming quite important from an international perspective, given the expansive reach of both the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act as well as the Bribery Act. So what kind of diligence can be done on government dealings as far as the Indian companies are concerned is again becoming an important aspect of diligence in the Indian context. And we've seen what has happened with the 2G licenses being annulled by the Supreme Court. So I think what kind of level of confidence one can repose on the licensing process, will it withstand judicial scrutiny if that is questioned before the court? I think these are, again, important considerations that must be raised in the diligence process going forward, and recent lessons have established that as well.
And one of the final points I want to kind of raise in the international and comparative context, since you mentioned about developed markets versus India, is often we think about due diligence along with definitive legal documentation, the reps and warranties and indemnities and so on. In the Indian context, legal documentation has become quite sophisticated, has become evolved, but it has never been tested before the courts in terms of any specific case as to whether reps and warranties and indemnities can be enforceable and so on. So while it is important to take reps and warranties and rely on those, due diligence perhaps in that context plays an important role, because there's only that much that you can rely on the reps and warranties, and you can't take one as a substitute to the other. So a thorough due diligence is certainly something that is a necessity in the Indian context, and these are some of the lessons that we have learned in the recent past.
Thank you so much, Professor Omakar. I think you touched
upon... Can I add...
sure, go ahead, Eva.
...a bit on diligence. We also have very active practice on litigation. And generally, when we see on litigation, we find that a lot of litigation we have done, whether in terms of private equity investment space or whether on M&A space, almost 80 to 90% of litigation could have been prevented at a hindsight if we had done a better diligence. If the company had done a better diligence, maybe they would have avoided the pitfalls which they did not see at that point of time, which they encountered leading to litigation. So always when, and the way we advise client is that often in a hurry to do the transaction, you kind of short-chain litigation into more of a tick box rather than trying to identify the real issues and seeing the implication, how it will happen once the company is acquired or once the investment is made. And then later on, figuring it out that, you know, wish you had looked at that particular issue in greater detail and possibly avoided a potential litigation. So I think the point I'm trying to say is that if the diligence was done little more strategically and little more thought, you know, a lot of thought was given to that, possibly a lot of pain would have been avoided in several situations. Thanks,
Vibha. So I think just to summarize, I think what we're saying today is that, you know, in India, the need for diligence is extremely is very important. The learnings from deals like USL, even Arch Pharma, you know, and Apollo Cooper and the likes suggest that not just the company needs to be diligent. I think what we're all saying today is that the promoters themselves need to be diligent as well, because in India we still rely heavily on promoter, especially in private companies, on the ability of the promoter to see the business through. And I think one, I mean, the panel didn't talk about it, but if I can just put it out there in terms of the level of, you know, things being available to the public. I suppose there's in the U.S. and, you know, in more developed jurisdictions, public information is more readily available. But I think what we have now, however, legislations like the Companies Act, which, you know, even private companies have to make robust filings and file them in the RFC, which are available to the public at large. We are looking to see that land records are looking to be digitized, which is a big step up for, you know, transactions in India, especially involving land and land assets. Litigation records, Vaibhav, you mentioned on litigation, I think those are also trying to be digitized, which again will, you know, bring about further impetus in terms of diligence in India. And we will also talk about the new regulations in terms of, you know, how important it is to do a thorough diligence. Boards will be taking more active roles in diligences as well. So I think from diligences, let's move to something that, you know, all of us need to think about in terms of the structure of any deal. So Nishal, maybe the question is for you. In 2014, what are the new innovative deal structures that you have seen? And we've seen a list of, you know, marquee deals in 2014. Maybe if you can give us your experience on deal structure.
Sure. So I will talk about few structures on the public M&A side and few structures on the private M&A side. As far as the public M&A side is concerned, we saw a lot of deals being structured as stock swaps in the form of a merger. And as we all know, two of the largest deals of 2014, Sun Pharma's acquisition of Rand Baxi and Kotak Mahindra Bank's acquisition of ING Vysya Bank were structured as merger. Now, the benefit of a merger is, there are three major benefits. First one is that in a listed company acquisition, any transaction which is structured as a merger is exempt from open offer obligation under the takeover code. So you don't have to spend that additional money to pay to the public shareholders in case the transaction is structured as a merger. Second advantage of a merger transaction is from an income tax perspective. Any transaction which is structured as a merger is tax exempt as per the Indian tax laws. The third advantage is from an acquirer's perspective, the acquirer does not need to pay cash to the shareholders of the target company because instead of cash, the shares of the acquirer are issued to the shareholders of the target company. And hence the target company can use those funds for making further investment in its, or rather the acquirer can use those funds for making investment in its own business. So we saw a lot of transactions, big ticket transactions being structured as merger. Another interesting structure on the public M&A side we saw was in case of Thomas Cook Sterling Holidays deal. This was a case where Thomas Cook acquired Sterling Holidays and this transaction actually had all types of share acquisitions and all types of asset acquisitions which one can think of. The transaction had a negotiated share purchase with the promoters. The transaction had a preferential allotment into Sterling Holidays. The transaction had market purchases structured as block and bulk deals. The transaction had an open offer. The transaction had a demerger of the timeshare and the resorts business to one of the unlisted subsidiaries of Thomas Cook. And finally, the transaction had a merger of Sterling with Thomas Cook. So almost all types of share and asset acquisitions were covered in the Thomas Cook Sterling Holidays transaction, which made it quite a unique transaction. And one of the reasons why this transaction was not directly structured as merger cum demerger, and the reason why Thomas Cook wanted to structured the transaction first in the form of share purchase followed by preferential allotment, was because they wanted to increase their shareholding in Sterling Holidays to a level where at the time when the merger and demerger comes to the shareholders for their approval, they are able to manage the 3/4 in value of the shareholder's approval. And that was also one of the reasons why there were multiple steps to the transaction. So this was one of the unique transactions of 2014. Another one which is currently going on is a SpiceJet transaction. Like we all know, Ajay Singh has decided to take control of SpiceJet from the Marans. And because there is going to be a change in control and substantial acquisition of shares, open offer typically would get triggered. But the way the transaction is being structured, and we need to see how it pans out, is there is a scheme of reconstruction which SpiceJet has gotten approval from Ministry of Civil Aviation. Now, what is the impact of this scheme of reconstruction is something unique, and maybe for the first time it will be happening under the takeover code, is that typically we have seen schemes of merger or amalgamation being exempt from open offer obligation under the takeover code. But the same exemption also covers a scheme of reconstruction approved by a competent authority. So in this case, a scheme of reconstruction for SpiceJet, which has been approved by Ministry of Civil Aviation, could be used as a ground for not making an open offer under the takeover code. So this is again something unique which will happen, once the matter goes to SEBI. But again, this was something quite unique. Couple of other things on the listed side, what we saw was there were a lot of promoter funding transactions where private equity funds funded the promoter holding companies for helping the promoters to do creeping acquisition in listed companies. These transactions are structured in a manner where, you know, there was no persons acting in concert risk or the private equity fund along with the promoter. So this was again quite interesting way of doing transaction. This was not something which has been prevalent or which was rather there from 2010 to 2013, but in 2014 we saw a lot of transactions happening through the listed non-convertible debt. Another thing which we saw on the listed side, and again this is becoming quite common for the acquirers, is business transfer from listed company. Now, there are two ways in which the acquirer can acquire listed companies. One is a share acquisition, and the other is there can be a business transfer to the acquirer's subsidiary in India. Now, the interesting thing here is if the acquirers do share acquisitions, then the problem is they will have to first make an open offer, followed by a delisting, followed by a squeeze out in case they want to take private the business in future. But the problem is the way the Indian regulations have been worded, it is difficult to delist a company and to squeeze out the minority shareholders. Although there are ways to do it, but it's a very long, strong process, because of which we have seen the acquirers preferring a business transfer or a slump sale route for acquiring the businesses. It's a bit tax inefficient, but it definitely reduces a lot of regulatory issues for the acquirer. So this is something which we have been seeing, and we saw the largest slump sale by a listed company in the form of Piramal Group sold their formulation business to Abbott subsidiary in India. And at that time, there were issues from minority shareholders that, we are not getting exit, there are no dividend which is being paid by Piramal Group to the minority, to the public shareholders. So this has been one of the interesting structures. We are working on a couple of transactions right now where, this model is being followed for sale of business by the listed company. On the unlisted side or the private M&A side, what we have seen is we saw a lot of flips happening where the Indian company got inverted to a foreign company, could be in the form of Singapore or a Dutch company, depending on the business objectives of the group. And the Indian company became a wholly owned subsidiary of the foreign company, and the shareholding in the Indian company got replicated at the foreign company level. This model has been quite successful for technology and e-commerce companies, primarily because the valuations are very attractive for a foreign company holding Indian business as compared to Indian company holding Indian businesses. Another thing that we saw on the private M&A side is to bridge the valuation gap between the sellers and the buyers. There were a lot of transactions structured as earnouts. So whatever was immediately required by the sellers for funding their other needs was structured as an upfront payment, and the valuation gap was adjusted in the earnout. And although there are certain issues for a foreign acquirer to structure earnouts, we had managed to structure some of the deals with earnout for even for foreign acquirers, which is possible with a slight tweak in the commercials of the deal. But broadly, what we saw was that although earnouts worked quite well for bridging the valuation gap between the sellers and the buyers, we also saw some of the earnout deals going into litigation at a later date because of the issue on what is the valuation of the earnout. And this is again something which the acquirers should also consider when they are structuring a transaction as earnout, that the valuation should be very specific to ensure that there is no dispute on the earnout at a later date. One of the other things which we also saw on private M&A side, especially for where the private equity backed companies were sold, was how do you structure the reps and warranties and indemnity from the private equity seller? And as we all know, typically all private equity funds are structured as limited life funds. And when they are exiting, they are nearing the end of their fund life. So how do you give comfort to the acquirers on the indemnity and the reps and warranties? And that, again, became a big issue in some of the deals in 2014. One of the solutions which came out, and it's something which has been quite common in developed countries, but has started being implemented in India in 2014, is a reps and warranties insurance. A lot of these insurance companies have started giving the reps and warranties insurance, which works well both for the buyer and the seller, because even if the seller or the private equity fund gets wound up because of the limited life nature, in case there is any indemnity obligation which gets triggered, the insurance company pays to the buyer. So this is another important thing, structure we saw on the reps and warranties and indemnity side in 2014 in some of the deals. So broadly, you know, these were the structures that we saw on the public and the private M&A side.
Thanks, Mr. I think keeping in mind the time that we have, Vaibhav, I think just, you know, structures, deal structures always has a regulatory ambit to it. Just wanted your thoughts, your 2-minute quick snapshot on, you know, any regulatory controversies that you might have seen in 2014.
Okay, so thank you, Simon. First, 2014, we saw a lot of regulatory changes, right from Companies Act, introduction of Companies Act, which made a lot of life uncertain and difficult for companies, which ended up also seeing a lot of lips, not just from tax perspective, but also from getting greater flexibility on Companies Act perspective. But I will focus on some of the changes which we have seen specifically affecting technology in e-commerce sector. The first one, there was a lot of uncertainty and still is on FDI in e-commerce companies. You know, we saw a lot of news items. We talked about investigations by ED in e-commerce company to see whether they are actually doing retail trading or whether they are FDI compliant companies. Some of the controversies which we saw, while it's not concluded and got into a particular result, the trend which we are seeing is as follows. First, there has been a very clear mindset of the government where they have said that FDI in a marketplace is completely possible and above FDI compliant. In fact, the first time in 2014, we saw an explicit approval from FIBB permitting investment in marketplace companies. Now, this is something which, in my view, brings a lot of certainty for marketplace. But what we also saw, that government is aware of a thin line between a marketplace and a retail trading e-commerce company or e-commerce retailing company. And government is has been very, very cautious in investigation in trying to understand how the payment flows are or what kind of control does the company marketplace have between a buyer and a seller to determine whether it is a marketplace or it is actually e-commerce a retailing company. And this particular scrutiny, in my view, will kind of increase as government is seeking to keep a thin line between the marketplace, which is permitted, and e-commerce retailing, which is not permitted. Second issue which we saw was with respect to payment. We saw a lot of Uber had an issue with Reserve Bank of India because a lot of aggregators were based outside India. And because they were based outside India, they charged money on credit card from dollars, and then they provided dollars back to Indian service providers. And what Reserve Bank of India saw that, and they said, you know, specifically because this is dealing between a service provider which is based in India and customer which is based in India, and hence any money which was being taken out and brought back needs to comply with Indian law and also specifically with respect to the dual authentication system. Now, that affected Uber primarily, but what people have not realized that it will affect all the aggregators, including Booking.com or Apple or you know, Google Play and a lot of other aggregators. And today, other aggregators have not really thought through on how they will deal with situations where their services, for example, where Booking.com provides the booking services for Indian hotels to Indian customers versus Booking.com providing non-Indian hotels to Indian customers. So I think that is one issue which we saw. The other issue which we saw with respect to technology, log remaining behind technology. So there were a lot of situations, for example, take Amazon situation where Amazon, in order to provide more guaranteed delivery, wants to stock all the goods from their sellers in their own warehouse. And that created a problem for Amazon because under Indian law, the sellers have to actually register the place where they are storing goods as the place of selling, as their place of sale of business. The problem is Amazon had goods stored from 300 vendors, and it was not anticipated by the government authorities that 300 vendors will have the same address for purpose of place of doing business or place of selling goods. And this is something which was not contemplated when the law was made, and ended up creating a lot of issues at the Amazon level. Similar issues have happened, for example, on the aggregators like Radio Cabs. You know, whether a radio taxi is required to have their own taxis, or if they are aggregators, then a private tourist vehicle can be used for taxis. Similarly, what happens in the car sharing, for example, the car sharing or giving lifts to people, you know, those kind of services or aggregators where you don't see a physical business coming, or existing physical business, but a new business being generated because of online or technology evolvement, and that is something which we have seen some kind of regulatory uncertainty being brought in. The last point I would want to bring here is we also saw a lot of changes, a lot of flexibilities in Reserve Bank of India's viewpoint from FEMA perspective too. You know, a couple of points we initially mentioned on earnouts and on indemnity. For the first time, we saw Reserve Bank of India being actually flexible in looking at a deal and you know, granting, for example, escrow, indemnity escrow as high as, let's say, 8 years. And also granting escrows more than 6 months for earnouts. So one thing is to structure it in a very creative manner, but now as time goes by, I think it is going to be possible to approach Reserve Bank of India and asking for an earnout escrow and asking for indemnity escrow more than 6 months of time in much more easy manner than what we saw it before. Also, I would just leave this point with one interesting situation we saw, which is a foreign owned and controlled Indian company. When they acquired another Indian company, which was held by Indian shareholders and also foreign shareholders, the question really came was, at what price or what pricing guidelines will apply to this particular transaction? Because a foreign-owned or controlled Indian company needs to meet the minimum pricing guidelines for purpose of Indian shareholders in order to comply with the downstreaming guidelines. But also because it was an Indian company, and when they paid money to the foreign shareholders, a cap was applicable to them, which means that the maximum price they could have paid to the foreign shareholders is the fair market value. So it turns out that because they need to pay Indian shareholder minimum pricing guidelines, as the minimum pricing guidelines applicable, they need to pay minimum fair market value. And because of the cap applicable for selling or purchasing shares from foreign shareholders, the maximum they need to pay is fair market value. So apparently this kind of structure, the only price which it was possible was doing a deal at a fair market value and making payment to both the shareholders at fair market value. And this is a situation which we saw where RBI also kind of got to a view saying that while we will do it at fair market value, we'll permit the transaction at fair market value, but if you need flexibility, we are open as long as there is a right business case.
Thanks, Vaibhav. I think it's all good to hear that regulators today are softening, and we'll deal with, you know, the 2015 big bang approval that the RBI has given in a bit. But again, cognizant of time, let's just move straight to, I think, shareholder activism. We've seen the regulators' views. We've seen, you know, controls over how businesses are going to be structured. I think a very important aspect of, you know, deal-making is shareholder activism. We started off, we discussed this a bit in the beginning. It's very interesting to note that there was a BNP Paribas Asia strategy report which suggested that the incidence of shareholder activism in India is more than any other Asian country. The next question is to Professor Umar Kant, whose expertise in this is in this subject area. What are the lessons that we've learned in 2014 so far? I mean, we've seen, you know, Ambuja Cements, minority shareholders, opposing Ambuja Cements payout to Holcim. We've seen institutions opposing Maruti Suzuki plans to buy cars from its parent. We've seen situations where, you know, hikes for top management of Tata Motors was questioned. So, Professor Makant, we'll draw on your experience to discuss minority shareholder activism issues in India in 2014.
Yeah, so if you look at a few years before in history, deal-making was very different in India. You know, you structured the deal between the company, the advisors, you got the board approval, but very little cognizance was taken of how the shareholders are going to react, because you had promoter support enough to carry the deal through. But things have changed over the years, probably 3 to 4 years, but we've seen the evidence of that take effect last year in 2014, which is that shareholders have become a lot more active, and this is particularly so in the context of M&A transactions. And I would attribute two reasons to this this kind of trend that we see. The first reason is because minority shareholders are getting more protection under the law itself. So the Companies Act of 2013 has given greater rights to minority shareholders, and so has various regulations issued by SEBI from time to time, particularly in the field of M&A. So if you were to take a transaction like the scheme of arrangement, restructuring, which is quite common in the Indian context, Now, the Companies Act requires certain related party disclosures and approval requirements. So if you have a transaction between companies, then that necessarily has to go to the shareholders for approval, where the minority does have a say. So effectively, you need a majority of the minority to approve the deal. So that gives a lot of power in the hands of minority shareholders, and that has also been the case with regulations that have come up with SEBI. So on the one hand, you see a lot of power being vested by SEBI in the hands of the minority shareholder. And the second is developments in the market itself. So you see institutional investors getting a lot more active than they have been in the past. And you also see another phenomenon which is not very common in other Asian countries, which is the active participation by the advisory firm who put out their recommendations for both institutional and retail investors to vote. So due to these developments, now you see that M&A transactions are carrying on a different tenor altogether, whereby you cannot ignore the rights and protection of the minority shareholders. So the lesson we learn from this approach is due to greater activism, the deal-making, deal-structuring must take into account how the questions of the minority shareholders are going to be answered. And the other few practical lessons we learned from this episode that we've seen in 2014 that you mentioned is, one is don't make the deal too complex, because greater complexity makes communication to shareholders more difficult, and that may actually cause them to react in a manner that is negative to start with, but they may later on agree to come on board, which we have seen in past deals. So I think communication is an important aspect that we have learned, and minority protection must actually figure in the deal-making process. So I think in a nutshell, to keep my answer brief, I think the whole scenario and the paradigm has shifted in the last 3-4 years much, much more than it has ever in the past. So deal structuring and implementation must take into account the fact that there will be activist shareholders and how the company must be prepared to deal with activism, and how exactly that is done is perhaps something that we can discuss in the next segment of the talk.
Thank you so much, Professor Omar. I think media risk is one more risk that we also need to look at from an India M&A perspective, and how shareholders, in addition to regulators, will react. I think linked to this point in terms of reactions, in terms of complexity, in terms of activism, I think we can't end the session without having a viewpoint from what the tax overall tax environment in 2014 has been. So, Nishal, I think I would have had since we're running out of time, especially on the which to withhold, not to withhold from a Vodafone issue. Has there been any clarity in 2014? Last year.
Sure. So I think in 2014, the uncertainty continued on whether to withhold or not. And the uncertainty was not only restricted to indirect transfers, which was the Vodafone type of transfer, but also for direct transfers where the sellers have been especially Mauritius companies. And the issue with that is, as an acquirer under the Indian law, there is an obligation to withhold tax before the acquirer makes payment to the seller, in case the transaction is taxable as per the Indian tax laws. And the problem arises because both the sellers and the acquirers have a different point of view on the taxability of the transaction, given the way the tax authorities have become aggressive in the last 5 to 6 years, especially on cross-border transactions. So even though we have a landmark Supreme Court judgment on Azadi Bachao Andolan, which exempts any transaction where a Mauritius company is selling shares of an Indian company from tax in India, because of the subjectivity and because of the concept of substance over form gaining prominence under the Indian tax system, a lot of acquirers are wary of paying the entire consideration to the sellers without withholding any tax. And that's where lot of negotiations take place just on the tax withholding and tax indemnity issue. In fact, in our experience, when we are negotiating a deal, we spend almost 30% of the time on negotiating the tax withholding and tax indemnity. And what we have seen is, depending on the bargaining power of the sellers and the buyers, we have seen one of these solutions working for getting the deal through. I think in some of the situations, the buyers have been happy with the tax indemnity from the seller. In other situations, what we have seen is the buyers have insisted that, from a certainty perspective, we want a tax insurance. And that product has also worked quite well in 2014 in a number of deals, although right now the insurance companies are falling short of the limits for insuring some of these transactions. Other thing which we have seen in some of the cases is the escrow and holdback structure, where part of the consideration is withheld till there is certainty on the tax. What we have also seen in very few cases is the acquirer being able to get a nil withholding order from the tax authorities for the transaction, or a lower withholding order. And last but not the least, we have also seen in some of the cases an advance tax ruling being sought from the Indian tax authorities on the taxability of the transaction, and that being a trigger for releasing the holdback on the escrow amount. So broadly, these have been the solutions which have worked in situations where the entities are, where the sellers are from jurisdictions where capital gains tax are exempt as per the treaty which India has signed with that particular jurisdiction. What we also saw in 2014 is, because of the Vodafone tax issue, which, in 2012, the government of India changed the law to tax indirect transfers, where if a share of a foreign company is being sold and the value of the share is derived substantially from the assets in India, then even though the transaction is completely offshore, the Indian tax authorities have a right to tax such transactions. And what we saw was because there is no percentage definition of what the substantial value mean, we saw a lot of uncertainty on the withholding issue between the international acquirer and the international seller. The reason being, under the Shom Committee report, the substantial value threshold was mentioned as 50%. But one of the latest reports, which was a draft direct tax code report, mentioned that the substantial value should be considered as 20%. So before this 20% draft direct tax code report came out, the insurers were willing to insure the risk till 30%, till the value of the foreign company or till the value of the Indian target was not more than 30% of the total value of the foreign company. But after the report came out, the new threshold has been set at 20%, although right now there are no limits available, but at least the right now it has settled at 20%, hopefully with the new government and the budget coming in February, on February 28th, we might see some clarity on the threshold issue.
Thanks, Nishul. And I think, you know, with that, let's move into 2015. I think we're sitting at a time, we're all waiting for the budget. You know, the Davos meet was, you know, all exciting about for India 2015 as starting off with the bang. I think my first question would be to you, Vaibhav. What is your assessment of, you know, the possible regulatory climate in 2015? Are there any specific areas that you will see liberalization? I mean, we've seen, you know, President Barack Obama being here. There's a lot of talk of a new nuclear deal pact being signed, being agreed to between India. A lot has been talked about in terms of defense insurance. What are your thoughts on, you know, liberalization and possible the regulatory climate in 2016?
Yeah, thank you, Simone. Also, in interest of time, I will be very crisp and quick here. The way I look at it, there's a lot of hope and optimism because of the statement which the finance minister and the prime minister is making, right from predictable tax design to making India an easier place to do business. They have been given, all the ministers have been given targets that India has to go below 100 in ease of doing a business factor, which currently India is more than 134. If you ask me where I will see in 2015, in my view, the technology and e-commerce sector will continue to be very strong, and a lot of activity will happen in technology and e-commerce sector, as well as on the healthcare sector. I think this year we will see a lot of private equity exits and a lot of transactions being done because of the private equity exits. In addition to those traditional sectors, where I see a lot of activity in 2015, in my view, energy, both the traditional energy as well as the clean energy, you see a lot of activity in this particular year. Secondly, infrastructure services company and other ancillary companies which deal with infrastructure, in my view, that companies will see a lot of activities. Real estate this year, in my view, will see a lot of activities. Engineering services companies, in my view, will see a lot of activities. And financial services companies. Now, these are the sectors where I think the activity will increase more than what you saw in 2014. There are two, three additionally which are relevant and important. Make in India has been a very significant slogan which Modi government has raised, but I personally don't see a lot of activity coming from Make in India concept in 2015, though there may be some in the end of the year, but mainly you will see it in 2016 and 2017. On public M&A side, I think there will be a lot of stock swap deals. Mainly, as you mentioned, some of the structure which was used, including the merger structure, to kind of take benefit of the deals available. But because the stock market has been increasing, the valuation has been increasing, there are more chances of stock swap deals happening in public M&A side than a private company buying the public company. I see in terms of sectors, in terms of geographies, a lot more India-US deals happening and to some extent India-Japan deals happening. But India-US deal should see a significant uptake in 2015. Also, we will see a lot more inbound and domestic deals happening than outbound deals. Indo-Europe deals, in my mind, will be significantly low and will continue low for rest of the year. I think this is my take on the 2015 M&A scenario.
Thanks, Devab. I think Nishal, a related question to this, I mean, Devab talked about energy, talked about real estate, talked about financial services, all very much linked to regulators, and we're talking about, you know, how the Modi government is promoting ease of doing business. And, you know, have you seen this, especially in the beginning of this year? It's been only a month, but have you seen a real change in terms of the regulators, the softening of the regulators today?
Yeah, actually, in two cases. One is, as we all know, that Reserve Bank of India has always frowned upon put options by foreign investors on Indian residents at an assured return. And been this stand, even though, you know, for quite some time there was nothing mentioned under the law prohibiting this, but this was the stand that they had taken. Although they mentioned, came out with a circular last year that, you know, assured return put options won't be allowed. Now, a significant departure from what the stand that they have been taking has been the recent Reserve Bank of India approval for Tata Docomo transaction, where, as we all know, for a foreign investor to exit at a price above the fair value of the share is something which is not allowed by RBI. But in this particular case, Tata Docomo was has been allowed by Reserve Bank of India to, or rather, Docomo has been allowed to exit at a price of 58 rupees when the fair value of the target company is 23 rupees. This is a significant departure from what we have seen in the past, where the bidders have always been strict in enforcement of the policies of the government. And one of the interesting things which is mentioned in the approval is that it is very important that the foreign investors get comfort that the contracts that they have entered into are enforceable in India. So contractual commitment is as important as, you know, the laws of the land. So this is something which is very comforting for the foreign investors, and I think the way I look at it is just beginning, and we will see more and more softening of the stand of various regulators to give comfort to the international investors. This is also something which President Barack Obama mentioned in the U.S.-India Business Summit yesterday, that it's not only doing the deal, but once the deal has been done, how do you ensure that the deal terms will be honored by, you know, the Indian party is also something which is important for any foreign investor investing in India. So the message is very clear from various international investors to Modi that, you know, unless things are softened, it's going to be difficult to make India a successful investment destination. The second softening of the stand which we saw is from the tax authorities. And as we saw, typically it's very standard for Indian tax authorities to appeal in case they lose some case against the taxpayer. But surprisingly, the last two transfer pricing cases on Shell and Vodafone, where the government or the tax department lost to Vodafone and Shell, the tax department has decided not to appeal. Now, this is again a significant departure from the adversarial approach which the tax authorities have been having in the last 5 to 6 years. And interestingly, the finance minister has given a 12-point guideline to the tax authorities on how they should approach, approach the taxpayers, or rather, what is the approach they should follow while they are, handling some of the tax cases. And one of the things they have mentioned is that unless you have a very solid case for winning, don't appeal. Now, this is again a significant departure from what we have seen in the past. And this is going to give a lot of comfort to the international investors. On top of that, yesterday Mr. Modi also mentioned on during the India-US Business Summit that one of the things they are looking at is removing the uncertainty on the tax regime. So he said that some of the creases have been ironed out in the last budget, but a lot of things we will see in, on February 28 when the budget is announced, where some of the things hopefully on the indirect transfer, the retrospective taxation, MAT on SEZ, you know, being reduced. I think some of the things which is going to achieve his vision on Make in India and attract foreign investors to invest in India, he's going to make a lot of changes in the budget for that.
So, Nishal, I think I was saving this question for the last, but since you've already dealt on it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if you can just throw a two-minute snapshot before we then move to regulations and what the board would be in terms of the Ministry of Guard, what is expected for the budget, and also the entire, you know, because VAT is also, implementation of VAT is going to be very important for doing business in India. If you can just throw light on those two aspects.
Sure. So as far as GAR is concerned, it is scheduled to be effective from 1st of April 2015. So we are actually just almost 2.5 months away from the implementation. But what we have been hearing from various quarters is that to give comfort to the international investors, the GAR may get delayed by at least 1 year, if not 1 year, by at least couple of years. We will have to see what comes out in the budget. But clearly, if GAR gets delayed, then that itself is going to be a big boost for the international investors to invest in India. Although, as Professor Umakant had also mentioned, more from a shareholder activism perspective, even from a GAR perspective, what we have been seeing in the last couple of years is that new structures which are set up are becoming more and more simple. And the reason for that is, even though GAR is going to be implemented from 1st April 2015 and could get delayed further, all structures which are set up post August 30, 2010 are going to be subject to GAR if the income arises from those structures post the introduction of the GAR. So even though GAR gets pushed by 2 years, if you have set up a structure between 2010 and the date when the GAR actually gets introduced or GAR becomes effective, if you are earning income from that structure post the introduction of GAR, you will get caught under GAR. So from complexity, things are moving more and more towards simplicity because of the tax issues and the over-regulation. Other thing that Simon mentioned about is on the goods and service tax, which is again going to be a major game changer for the Indian industry. And the reason for that is, in fact, one of the top business icons of the country said that if GST gets introduced, it itself can add at least 2% to the GDP growth rate, which means, again, when GST is introduced, there will be lesser complexity. You don't have a VAT, you don't have a CST, you don't have a service tax. Rather than working on three regimes, you have just one regime, which is going to streamline a lot of things supply. And all these things will become much simpler. There is a lot of buy-in which the states have given to the central government on the GST issue. And I think the last, some of the last points need to be sorted out. Once these are done, hopefully we'll see GST being implemented in 2015-16.
Thanks. So Ankit, maybe I can just, call upon you to give us, you know, an overview of new legislation, because we've seen a flurry of them in the beginning of this year. And then, you know, we will end the session with lessons to the boards, because I think that's where the decision-making comes in, to summarize in terms of what the board should do with Professor Umakant.
Sure. I think just in the interest of time, very quickly, I think we've discussed most of the points, but just to summarize, you know, the key pain points of doing M&A and corporate restructuring, the issues were primarily two. One was that, at least in terms of listed companies, acquirers were not able to acquire 100% of the company because of the public shareholders' requirements of a minimum 25%, and you could not launch an automatic sort of delisting pursuant to an open offer. That was point one. Point two is the delisting process itself was very onerous, and it was lopsided in favor of the minority shareholders, and it requires two-thirds public shareholders to vote on it. The pricing requirements of reverse book building were extremely onerous. The third point is the issue of equity squeeze out, which was even relevant to non-listed companies. You could not squeeze out the minority shareholders. And a live example is the Cadbury case, where, you know, even after 5 years, the controlling shareholders have not been able to squeeze out the minority. Now, I think Nishal spoke in the beginning about how we're seeing more and more transactions being structured as mergers, but largely it is being structured in the context of domestic transactions. There's still mergers have not become extremely a viable option for cross-border transactions, essentially because the restriction on share swaps, an Indian company could not merge with a foreign company, and the onerous timelines attached with the approval, court approvals, because we do not have a specialized sort of court that undertakes these sort of measures as of today. And fourthly, the issue that we've already discussed, the issue of disclosures, the level of disclosure, though has leaves a lot to be desired, and the issue under the insider trading regulations, which did not allow you to sort of conduct a robust due diligence. Now, in the last one and a half years, we've seen all these being addressed, at least in principle. Firstly, the SEBI in its last board meeting has in principle approved the concept of a take private transaction, so you can acquire 100% of the company pursuant to a direct open offer. We're seeing a change in the delisting regulations, which is becoming a more level playing field between the controlling shareholders and the minority shareholders, though the delisting regulation itself, even the new one, leaves a lot to be desired. The third point is the disclosures are becoming more robust. There is a discussion paper out there, if implemented, would really result in increase and enhanced and better quality of disclosures. Insider trading regulations, I think last month itself, we have seen the new regulations come out, which categorically permits you to do due diligence if you are making an open offer. And the two, three other points, the new companies act, though parts of which have been notified, allows a minority squeeze out, allows the minority to make an offer to the majority. And lastly, though not fully implemented, is the specialized tribunals, the NCLT, National Company Law Tribunal, and the appellate tribunals. I think the approval process for mergers and scheme of amalgamations are going to improve, and foreign acquirers will find it more attractive to go down the merger route instead of a secondary acquisition. So there are quite a few of these changes which certainly will create an environment for corporate restructuring and M&A. But there is obviously that caveat. All this is currently in principle form, and unless it's fully implemented and unless the drafting is crystal clear, you will not have the full effect of these legislations. So they're good with the caveat that implementation is key.
Thanks, Ankit. And I think all of this, leads or goes back to decision-making at the board, because where else will, decision-making for M&A come through? Professor Makant, I think your thoughts on, what the board should keep in mind in 2015, especially given the responsibilities given the New Companies Act, both private companies public companies. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah. So certainly, given all the complexities we've come across in the M&A space in India, and given the challenges boards are facing today due to additional regulation, there's going to be a lot of focus on how boards are going to decide. So activist investors are going to look at them, regulators are going to look at them. So I think the decision-making process itself will be fairly important. So given the lessons we have, what are some of the steps that they can take? Firstly, I think the decision-making process must be carried out properly. So even simple things like, do you approve a deal on the first meeting at which it was placed? That could be one question, because that could show that perhaps the board approved the deal in a hurry. That may be questioned later by one of the persons that I just mentioned. What other mechanisms were employed by the board to take into account the interests of the minority shareholders? And to me, it seems like, at least in large public M&A deals, there's going to be a lot more focus on the independent members of the board. And we've seen that happening in 2014 itself, where the activist investors are going to raise questions about what are the independent directors doing, maybe even target the independent directors. So I would think that in a very large M&A deal, it may even be worth following the practice that followed in other international markets, such as to get a committee of independent directors to consider and approve the deal, and maybe even that committee can be advised by a separate set of financial and legal advisors, a practice which is only picking up in India off late, but given the new sensitivities, might have to be taking on a more important role. So I think there's going to be a lot more focus on boards and how they operate, particularly the independent directors. And the other issue to think about from a board's perspective is, of course, it's going to be increased risk of liability to a large extent. Although whether independent directors are going to be personally liable or not, given the Indian enforceability issues, is a different matter, but there could be risks to reputation and other related questions. So so they will have to act in the appropriate manner. And the other issues that boards need to keep in mind is one is communicate with the investors. And I think that's how you communicate, at what point of time do you communicate, is going to be important given the new trend that we've started seeing on shareholder activism. So to keep an eye on the investors' pulse is going to be something to keep in mind. And finally, boards will have to be a lot more transparent than they have been in the past in terms of coming out with more information, disclosures, perhaps more on an real-time basis than they have been. So I would think the process, simplicity, and communication, these are the three things that boards will have to do in order to keep on par with the enhanced requirements that laws have imposed on them lately, given the new company act regime.
Thank you so much, Professor Umakanta. I think drawing from what you said, I mean, this should also apply to, although more relevant for public listed companies, should also apply for private companies, given the fact that class action suits today can be filed with respect to any company. And, you know, I think we are done for, let's wrap up the panel discussions today. And I think we will open for questions to the audience.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on your touchtone telephone. Participants are requested to only use handsets while asking a question. Anyone who has a question at this time may press star and one. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Ma'am, there are no questions from the audio conference. Meanwhile, would you like to take questions from the audience?
Okay, I think our panel has been extremely explicit in their discussions. We have no questions. Maybe I will just, you know, since we're sitting at a break of 2015, maybe I will ask each of the panelists to just give a 1 minute, to summarize what their thoughts for 2015 are. We're sitting in the beginning of the year. Looking ahead to a lot of activity, looking ahead for a lot of expectation. A lot is riding on this government. A lot is riding, on the government and also the economy that is looking up. So maybe we'll start with you, Nischal, Ankit Weber, and then Professor Umakanta.
Sure. I think clearly 2015 is going to be a big bang year for M&As, primarily because of the optimism which Modi has created in the last 8 months of his prime ministership. And one of the things, we have been seeing a lot of changes. Yesterday he mentioned he wants to make India, you know, among the top 50 countries for ease of doing business, which itself is one of the, which could provide one of the biggest boosts to M&As, because after acquisition, the acquirers want to ensure that they have ease of doing business in India. Another thing which, as I mentioned, the non-adversarial treatment from the tax authorities is also going to play a major role. In fact, tax uncertainty was the reason why India became unattractive as an investment destination in 2012 because of the multiple measures introduced by the by Pranab Mukherjee at that time. Another thing as we discussed was the regulator softening the stand on various issues and some of the key regulations being liberalized. In fact, one of the other things which is a welcome change is in the new insider trading regulations which are going to be effective from 15th of May 2015. Under each sub-regulation, there is an interpretation note which itself is which shows the intent of the regulators that they want to give certainty to the stakeholders on whatever they are doing. be it insider trading or, you know, be it some other law, there are more and more public consultations which are being held by regulators to get the views of the industry. So overall, to me, 2015 looks like, you know, it's going to be a big bang year for M&As in India.
I think everybody is sort of in agreement that 2015 is going to be a big bang year. But, I mean, if you look at from an M&A perspective, M&A is a long-term game. You know, the governments are here for 5 years. But when you make an acquisition or you do a merger, you are looking at a very long-term phenomenon. You're looking at more than 5 years, 7 years, 10 years. So from that perspective, I think what is more relevant from a foreign acquirer and even the domestic boards is the confidence they have in the certainty with which we are moving in the regulatory direction. The regulations have to be certain. We have to be consistent with our regulation. And most importantly, I think everybody is going to wait and watch whether certain structural reforms are taken to ensure that the economy is in a long-term, from a long-term perspective, in a right direction. So I think in the first half of 2015, especially prior to the budget, I think a lot of foreign acquirers and even the domestic companies are going to wait and watch whether words are being given effect to. And I think once that is done and there is a clear signal that we are moving in the right direction, we will see an increase in deal activity, I think, in the second, later half of 2015.
I think you mentioned important points, Ankit, but, you know, one thing we didn't touch upon on this panel was the role of the CCI, the Competition Commission of India, who is the nodal authority to actually regulate mergers and acquisitions of a certain size. And I think, you know, just to talk about the Jet Itihad situation where the term control has always been a gray area as to how it's defined, how it's used, how it's discussed, whether it is different for different regulations. And I think we've seen quite a welcome decision by the SEBI, as well as the SEBI sticking to its stand, saying that control for the purposes of the competition legislation may be different from control for the purposes of the takeover code, even though the definitions are extremely similar. And I think the Competition Commission also has been quite fast in giving its approval, which was one of the biggest concerns from a foreign in comparison to other regulators. So I think that has been also a welcome change. For the first time we've seen the regulators in Sun Pharma where there was requirement for divestment or phase two actually that went through, and there was a question of divestment that was actually required. So it's been interesting. Let's see what the commission does going forward. But I think it's safe to say that the commission has instead of being a roadblocker to M&A, has sort of promoted M&A, and hopefully that's how we won't really see loggerheads with regulators even going forward, given what happened in 2014.
Yeah, I think two things I think the industry is looking forward to. One is that they are looking for specific merger guidelines, where the CCI has consistently for the last 1 year taken the view that it is too early for such guidelines to come out. But I think if those guidelines do come out, it is going to be really helpful for the industry. And second is there needs to be a little more coordination between the CCI and SEBI, because the timelines get affected because there is a certain way CCI operates and then there is the open offer timelines. So I think on those fronts, there needs to be some level of coordination between the CCI and SEBI. And if that coordination comes through, it's going to make it easier for deal makers, I think, in 2015.
Sure. Maybe we can have your thoughts in 2015 and then move to
my thoughts are very simple. What Modi government is doing is basically bringing laws and regulations in line with the foreign markets. So the way I am looking at it is the structures and the deals which you see in US, in Europe, in other parts of the world, you should start seeing that in India too at some point in time. So, for example, you may see a lot more stock swaps happening, which currently does not happen, especially in the private M&A space. A lot more earnouts being happening, so regulatory regime for earnouts being kind of liberalized. Guidelines, as we discussed earlier, already the Reserve Bank of India is kind of taking a lenient view, and I think that's more likely to happen more and more on that side. What I'm also expecting is a lot more procedural related changes than even substantial related changes. One of the major issues on ease of doing business in India has not really been that the laws are not at par with the world standard, but the procedure and the actual implementation is very weak. And I think this government is pushing a lot more towards online and e-governance. So this year also I expect that a lot of e-governance and online form filing will make life easier for a lot of people on doing transactions. Now, having said it, as Ankit mentioned earlier, regulatory is simply a nibbler in a sense that that's something which allows things to happen faster and better. But always the transactions or M&A happen because of the business and not because of the regulation. You know, till now, transactions were happening despite the government regulations. Maybe in future it will happen because of government regulation, but that will simply make it easier. But the transactions generally will happen because of the strong belief in Indian market. And as a result, you would expect transactions happening to capture Indian market as a key component. And that is something which will survive not just 5 years, but 10 years or more. So you would also expect that, going forward, you will see a lot more labor relaxation. So you will expect that at some point of time, transactions will happen to acquire a manufacturing facility or facility to basically allow the work to happen in India. So both from Indian market perspective as well as Indian workforce perspective, you will see increase in number of M&As. I don't expect in 2015 lot of activity happening to acquire technology or IP, but when I see how China is operating and the transformation of Chinese companies from being copycat and imitators and violation of intellectual property to one of the topmost filing patent filing companies coming from China, for example, in Internet of Things space, which is a sector of future. When you look at the maximum number of patents filed, it is not IBM or it is not Cisco, which is leader in IoT, but it is ZTE, which is a Chinese company, which has filed the maximum number of patents in the world. And if you see the Chinese company going and acquiring companies, they are acquiring not for markets, as India is doing, but they are acquiring for getting technology and patents. At some point of time in 2016 or 2017, I expect that Indian companies also follow suit, where a lot of acquisition will happen for technology intellectual property basis. But I don't see that happening very easily in 2016.
Thanks, Devok. Professor Umakant?
Yeah, I think some of you have very elaborately dealt with the regulatory and legal aspects of what is expected in the next year or so. So I just want to confine myself to something which I desire probably more than I might see is in terms of what is it that we can, we would like to see in the coming months in the Indian context. And sticking on to the non-legal side of things, I think one of the things is perhaps it is given what we've seen in the previous year and before that, it's probably necessary to regain some of the trust in the Indian context because of what we've seen in the deals that have gone sour. So, in terms of deal sophistication, in terms of transparency, in the manner in which deals are carried out from a non-regulatory point of view, I think that itself is quite important in terms of how the international markets view Indian companies. And secondly, linked to that is perhaps we would like to see some more enhanced governance, especially in large companies which may become targets or sellers, governance practices and mechanisms in terms of how they do the deal is something which is again desirable and that would change the tenor of the Indian markets from an M&A point of view going forward. So I think desirability in terms of regulatory coordination, etc., and legal enabling regime is one thing, but I think changing the market itself from the outlook perspective is another thing which is also desirable in parallel. And finally, I know some of us have been pessimistic about this, but I think one would like to see a more outbound deals in the near future from Indian companies. And perhaps, I'm hoping that that's something that that trend will again pick up after a few years in the coming year in 2050. Maybe I'm being too optimistic, but that's something that we could look to as well. So in a nutshell, yes, there is a lot of hope, and I agree with you that I think this is a interesting year and perhaps an exciting year to watch out for.
Thank you so much. I think we have one question from the audience.
Yeah. This is OP Agrawal from SMC Capital. I just want to understand that Mr. Nishal was mentioning about the foreign acquirer taking the Indian listed company with a, like, you know, that 25% shareholding public participation. So what can be the reasons or what are the concerns they would not want to go with that 25% participation in the company and go for the delisting process, etc.?
So basically, if there is a strategic acquirer and he doesn't want the Indian target to remain listed, because ultimately if they are holding 100% of the share capital, they can control the company the way they want. The problem is if the target is a listed company, and first thing you will have to do is negotiate the deal with the promoters, right? And typically, you know, if the promoter is holding more than 25%, which in all probability it would be, there will be a need for making an open offer. So first is you have to make an open offer, which means another 26% public shareholding, you have to give an exit. After doing that, you have to apply for delisting, right? And for delisting, there are certain stringent requirements which at times the RS are not able to fulfill. Even if they are able to delist the company, the balance shareholders which remain in the company who did not tender their shares in the delisting offer, they need to be squeezed out, because then only the acquirer will be able to get 100% of the company. So this entire process of open offer to delisting to squeeze out is not something which is simple in India. As compared to that, if you look at developed countries, the process is quite simple. You can, you know, easily squeeze out the shareholders in those companies. So one of the alternatives which a lot of companies have started using is, instead of acquiring the listed company itself, you are more interested in the business of the company rather than the company itself. So there is a slump sale or a business transfer which takes place from the listed company into acquirer's Indian subsidiary. So there are many advantages. One is you don't have to go through this entire process of delisting and squeeze out. Second, you don't take over the liabilities which are attached to the company and not to the business. So there are a lot of advantages to this. Plus, the third advantage is you also get a step up on the cost of acquisition when you are acquiring the business at a premium, which in case you are selling the, you are acquiring the shares of the company and then selling the business at a later date, you don't get benefit of step up on the cost of acquisition for the business. You only get for the shares. So broadly, because of these reasons, we have been seeing a lot of deals being structured as business transfer or slump sale in a listed company situation as compared to a pure share acquisition.
Yeah, and also just to add, I mean, the objective of such deals is to acquire the entire company as a whole. And you can't remain listed if you acquire the entire company as a whole. Or that's your intention. It's very difficult to do it. Because the minute, say, suppose you are at 70 and you make a public offer for the remaining shares of the company and you go above 75, again you need to, you know, come down to 75 to maintain that listed, and that's not the economic, that's not the commercial intent of the acquirer. And, you know, it's not that they don't really want the retail participation. The objective is to control 100% as opposed to having, you know, other shareholders having a say in the business. So
my only point was that why should they be interested only on the 100% acquisition? Like, you know, with the 25% public participation, they can continue doing business and
so
at a later date when they want that.
So for example, just to give example of SpiceJet, right? Now, it's a distressed acquisition. Now, in a distressed acquisition, the target company would need more funding, right? Now, if in such situation, if you have to actually make an open offer to public shareholders, then that money which would have gone into the company to take it out from the distress is going to the public shareholder. So this is just one example of why, you know, people, the acquirers would want to avoid an open offer. The second example is that, you know, you are not interested in keeping the company listed. You know, and a lot of MNCs have global policy not to have their subsidiaries listed in local jurisdictions. So in that situation also, some of these structures work well for them.
So I think with that, we will conclude with this session, the lessons learned from 2015 for deal making in 2015. Thank you all for being a wonderful audience.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desa and Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.